or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and Dell. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar and Washington Times Senior Correspondent Deborah Simmons. You'll also hear Jason Fornicola's interviews with retired U.S. Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Thad Allen, Hooks Book Events President Perry Hooks, and author Daniel Pink. Welcome to Inside Government.
Good to be with you.
So let's talk about the 2010 midterm elections. They're behind us now. What's your reaction to all this?
Well, I think that it's a disappointment to see how many ultra-conservatives have been able to cross the finish line into victory. But I don't lose hope for the future. I think we've seen historic elections in the past where in the midterm after a presidential election that seems so optimistic that there is a pushback, and we've seen major pushback. In this case, we've had a lot of forces moving against the Obama administration and some of the actions of Congress. I think there have been some really good successes made, but they've been misinterpreted by 24-hour talk television, the Tea Party, and the radical conservatives who want Obama to fail. And I think it's a good wake-up call for progressives to think about what's next. There was a couple signs of good news yesterday. For example, in both California and in Florida, Common Cause, working with our partners across political lines, passed some new redistricting provisions. In California, we protected the fact that after this election, the new lines for congressional races and state legislative races will be drawn by an independent commission rather than the incumbent politicians in Sacramento. Likewise, in Florida, we won an initiative to have some certain principles put in terms of redistricting. In Florida, they have the worst system because the incumbent legislature have crafted the districts to make sure incumbents get reelected over and over again. So I think there'll be more diversity and more opportunity for districts to represent all of the people rather than simply be rubber stamps for the incumbents. We've got a lot of work to do. Common Cause is interested in getting money out of politics, and I don't think there's anyone who believes that after the Supreme Court's outrageous Citizens United case last year, giving corporations the opportunity to dip into their corporate treasuries on independent expenditures. I don't think there's anybody who believes that corporations haven't influenced the outcome of this election. And Common Cause and a number of our partner groups are going to work in double time to make it clear to the American public that we want public officials to serve the public interest and not the special interest. We want citizen-owned elections, not corporation-owned elections. And it's now time for us to really step up and step out. We've got a major plan at Common Cause to launch a 20-city effort with rallies and editorial board meetings and listening opportunities to really make sure that we listen carefully to the people across the country, but allow for progressives of all political stripes to reorganize and get back into the game.
But do you think with Republicans in control of the House, that's going to be a problem getting that kind of legislation through?
Well, I think we have to remember we still have the president's veto, and we've got to encourage the president to use it. I think it will be difficult to get legislation passed, given the makeup of the new House of Representatives, that is fair and equitable across the board. But this is a time for citizens of all political persuasions to begin to ask the question, do we have the government we need for this century, or do we have the government that has been bought and paid for by corporations? And if we can get enough citizen support I think we can make some changes. Let's remember that part of what happened yesterday is a reaction to the economic downturn that started in the former Bush administration, and it's a economic downturn that cannot be turned around overnight. It's not going to be turned around by giving large tax reductions to particularly the wealthy, and it's not going to be turned around if we don't focus on the real issues of creating an economic environment where the working poor and the poor have access to quality of life. I'm reminded of actually of what Henry Ford discovered back in the early part of the century when he raised the salaries of the Ford auto workers and got condemned as a socialist by some of his peers because he was giving them $5 a day. And when asked why he did it, he said, "Well, the reason I gave them that amount of money is that if they didn't make that money, they couldn't buy the Model T Ford." And he was one of the first corporation executives who fully understood that workers had to get an adequate wage. The new chair of our board, Robert Reich, former labor secretary, just wrote a book called Aftershock, which describes the disparity between the wealthy getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And I hope that working with our partners across the country in labor and business and environment, we can help people realize that we've got to stop the gross disparity between the rich and the poor and begin to focus on what qualities we want in America. And it's going to be difficult, but, you know, I'm both a minister and a politician. I spent many years as a United Methodist preacher and many years as a member of Congress. And wearing both hats, I realized that none of the prophetic voices of the past ever had a majority. None of them ever took a poll to figure out what was right and what needed to be done. And it was a handful of people that changed the world and changed society. And even Dr. King, when he led us through the civil rights movement, led by example and was able to overcome great odds. And I think organized labor, average ordinary people need to bind hands and recognize that even if we don't have a working majority on the day after this midterm, I do think we have the passion and the history to work together to see systemic change in a positive direction and stand up against the ultra-conservative forces that seem to have won the day yesterday.
Well, unfortunately, you're not going to be the majority leader in the Senate, although I wish you were. Are you worried that with Democrats in control of the Senate, to the extent that they really are with a filibuster and everything else, do you think Congress is going to essentially be a do-nothing Congress over the next 2 years? Because it seems like things are more partisan than they were 2 days ago. And I don't see when the Republicans were kind of running on tax cuts, being the party of no, the Tea Party people coming in who certainly don't seem to buy the, you know, what we do for the least among us, you do for me concept with government. Are we going to be even able to pass a budget?
Well, I think there's going to be disruption, but I think the Republicans need to be very careful because the anger out there that swept them into office was an anger that wanted the new government to move into positive direction to fix the economic problems we face. And if they don't, I think there'll be another major overhaul 2 years from now that may swing the pendulum way, way back in the other direction. Secondly, I think this should be a wake-up call to the Democratic leadership in the Senate. I think they were too cautious and too conservative over the last 2 years. I met with a senator recently who said the radical right in politics had an echo chamber, a voice out there that was very difficult, and that the Democrats didn't have a counter voice. Shame on the Democrats. Shame on the progressives for not being courageous to change the filibuster rule in the Senate, being courageous to stand up against all of the spending on war and defense. We need a strong practical defense system, but we're spending an awful lot on the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan that was off budget for so many years, and very few of the conservatives have taken ownership of how much money has been spent. We need a strong practical defense system that is more like a international police effort. We need to do what we've done with the recent package bombs that were stopped, and the liquid bombs that were stopped in Great Britain. That was done by a police action, not by a military action. And I'm afraid both Democrats and Republicans have a World War II image of how to hold the defense budget together, and a lot of the conservatives are pork-barreling defense contracts that are no longer needed. And you know, you can't really get a handle on the deficit if you don't take a look carefully and creatively at the issues of reducing our defense expenditures and focusing on real needs and adequate minimum wage, adequate worker benefits, adequate health care, closing the disparity between the rich and the poor. All of those things are what is needed to change this economy, and the progressives that still remain in the House and Senate need to be courageous on those issues.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government, and military employees. Purchasing Power has a hassle-free way for you to buy computers, electronics, and home appliances through easy payroll deduction. You can get a 16-gigabyte Apple iPod Nano or a Sharp Aquos 40-inch LCD HD TV, along with many other great items for the holidays. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Deborah Simmons, Washington Times senior correspondent. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's election season again. 2010 midterms are behind us. What's your reaction?
Right. Well, you know what? I think it was some kind of mix between all my children and the days of our lives, because there were no eulogies last night. You know, the Republicans had their victories with the House and some gubernatorial races, and the Democrats had theirs as well in with the Senate. There were no eulogies. And you know why I say that? Mostly because we know just 2 years ago, the huge push from the youth vote and the independents put Obama over the top in the presidential race. And as much capital as he's expended, both on policies and on the campaign trail this season, that's not the constituencies who came out and voted yesterday. We saw a lot of middle-aged Americans and senior citizens, as well as a lot of independents who expressed their vote because they're part of the Tea Party activists, which everybody thinks is in the pocket of the Republican Party, but there really are a lot of independents in the Tea Party movement itself. And those are the folks who were speaking spoke the loudest on Tuesday night, even though we know there are, maybe a dozen or so House races that are still too close to call.
Well, do you think, as I was watching it, I mean, the people that got the attention were, you know, O'Donnell, Engel, the more extreme, the Palins of the Tea Party. But
Right.
Was there somebody who made sort of an eloquent case for the Tea Party people? I mean, Rand Paul won. I mean, he seemed to be making the case about the Civil Rights Act or something. But I mean, who was actually making the case for the Tea Party?
Well, I think it was actually Rand Paul. His campaign included not just what people like to characterize as right-wing Republicans or the wacky people or even the Tea Party activists themselves, but the campaign of Rand Paul actually thumped on cutting spending, getting Americans back to work, and to an extent, what President Obama had pledged to do when he came to Washington, when he moved into the White House, and that was get rid of some of this partisan sniping that's going on, which of course we know he wasn't able to do. But then again, on the other side, you had unions played a humongous role in both wins and losses on Tuesday night, and a large part of that had to do with the amount of spending that went on.
Well, when you talk about the spending that went on, I mean, obviously after Citizens United, I mean, there's all kinds of spending from heaven only knows where.
Right.
Do you think anything's going to be done about that, or now that the Republicans have won and benefited from all this incredible spending from who knows where, are they going to kind of tamp down and defeat any legislation that might corral some of that?
Parties are going to have to do, and that's they're pushing ahead already to the 2012 presidential elections. Let's not think that that's on the back burner right now, because it ain't. It's really on the front burner right now. But what each party has to do, particularly the Democrats and the Republicans, and not so much those to the lesser extent, is they have to play what each side called the middle, because the historical constituencies, which were broken down into African Americans, Hispanics, you know what I mean, and those mm-hmm. traditional constituencies that everybody looks to, were kind of blurred. Those lines were blurred in the results that we saw last night. So I think they're going to have to focus on issues. For example, Eric Cantor, who was number two in the House because Republicans were not in control and will not gain control in the House until January, has already come out and said that the health care reform legislation is number one on their – repealing health care reform is number one on their issue. And John Boehner, who will likely become Speaker of the House come January – and is poised to become Speaker of the House, was focusing on what Americans have said they wanted and what the polls, whether they were taken by Rasmussen or whoever, have said want by voters. They want Republicans and Democrats to work together to solve Americans' issues, number one. And number two, jobs and the economy are still the number one issue that on voters' minds. I mean, people are unemployed. They're losing their houses. Even middle-class voters who ordinarily would send their children to private religious schools are finding themselves more and more leaning on public education, for example, for their kids because they can't afford these private schools. So the issues of, I think, education is going to be back on the front burner, but more importantly, jobs in the economy. And we know that the stimulus plan hasn't been working. There are, I have a lot of union workers in my family, and my immediate family, that is, and many of them are teachers or government employees. And everybody is a bit nervous about where we will head if the government cuts spending. And that's from diddling with Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, to the very real reality that we might face tax increases. And who can afford that in this kind of economy? People are literally losing their shirts. It's not, you know, it's no longer a figure of speech we're dealing with here.
And, you know, let's talk about it close to home. I mean, as you mentioned that when people talk about cutting government spending, I mean, in a time when the economy is tight, when unemployment is high, can we really afford to cut spending? Because cutting spending is going to mean jobs. Like you're talking about, teachers may get laid off. Teachers are going to be furloughed. Government employees are going to be furloughed. And in this election, which sort of looks demographically like 1994, Return of the Angry White Guy, is this going to be something that's only going to make the economy worse?
Yeah, but this time it's not the era of the angry white guy. It's the angry of the angry black single mother or single father who may be on the government dole right now because he's lost his job and he still has a family to take care of. And then you've got the immigration issue, quote unquote comprehensive immigration issue that could hurt a lot of folks. And even look at the prison situation. While we were sending oodles and oodles and oodles of black men to prison, and even black women to prison, for 12, 14, 15 years, those people are coming home. So there's the possibility of fewer prison jobs, whether they're unionized or not, which means there's the possibility of prisons closing, whether we want them to or not. And we have to figure out a way that now that we literally have tens of thousands of ex-felons returning home from those years of incarceration, most of them can't get a job simply because when they fill out an application, it asks, have you ever been convicted of a crime? And then digs into a deeper hole. And, you know, a less favorable worker or employee as they fill out that piece of paper. That's why I said these constituencies, the historical constituencies, are no longer the same that we saw either in the presidential run or even in recent years.
Do you think, as we talk about education and teachers, though, as federal funding kind of goes downhill, if there's no second round, third round of stimulus, if federal funding's going to be cut, that's going to hit the district. And when it hits the district, are we going to be closing schools? Are we going to be laying teachers off? Are these single parents going to be sending their kids to larger class sizes?
No. Listen, here's what's going to happen. And I think D.C. is a perfect microcosm of what's going to happen nationally. There's always been a push for universal pre-K programs. They have actually begun manifesting themselves. And coupled with the fact that the economy has hurt the pocketbooks of people who traditionally can afford to send their children to private schools, the enrollment in public schools, because of traditional public schools as well as charter schools, is on the rise nationally, and particularly here in the district. And you have a mayor-elect who, Vincent Gray, who has been in the forefront, a Democrat, by the way, been in the forefront of the universal pre-K push. We have thousands of kids under the age of 5 years old who are now enrolled in public schools simply because their parents can't afford that private daycare and those private schools. So I think what the teachers union may look at is figuring out how to work, particularly when they're up on Capitol Hill and in state and local governments, how to work with Democrats, because this is one issue that's obviously evolving, and that's how do we get a cadre of pre-K expert certified people to teach the children. Whether you want them there or not, it's not the issue. Because I'm not keen on having 2, 3, and 4 year olds who are still in Pampers or Huggies or whatever you call them in the classroom. But it's obvious that this is an issue that has taken off, and we need to find out a way how we focus on academics with these very, very young, influential, hearts and minds, the same as we do in schooling when we make sure that teachers are certified in the subjects that they are actually teaching. Because we don't want these teachers to come in these pre-K programs as mere babysitters. We can't afford to have that. We know what the academic standings are, the dropout rates, the illiteracy rates are, and we can't afford to have another generation following on those tracks. So I would think one of the first things the teachers unions would do is get together with these lawmakers and policymakers and make sure that the people who are teaching these very young hearts and minds know exactly what they're doing academically. And then number two, and this is the role where the Teamsters and others mothers come into play because they're the school bus drivers, they're the cafeteria workers and those sort of things. The way the nation is moving with more healthier cafeteria offerings, physical education programs and the like, that the education unions, the teachers unions, and the cafeteria worker unions and those folks actually make sure that not only are we following the laws and policies that are being implemented, but they're also playing a role in making sure they're being effective, that they're actually doing what that needs to be done. And that's one of the key roles I think that unions can play.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Admiral Thad Allen, former commandant for the U.S. Coast Guard, who also led the U.S. response to the BP oil spill and assisted as well in the Hurricane Katrina response. Welcome to the show, Admiral.
Glad to be here.
Now, one of the things we wanted to get from you today is your thoughts on the importance of having strong leadership from the federal government during a time of crisis. Talk a little bit about that and how important that is.
Well, it's extremely important, but I go beyond that. It's a mandate that that the public expects. They will expect a whole of government response and unity of effort. And I think our challenge is to grow leaders that are capable of doing that.
And talk about that whole of government response. That's one of the things that you mentioned here during your opening keynote speech at the Excellence in Government Conference, that the public expects during a time of crisis a whole of government response. Talk about what that is and how we go about achieving that.
Well, every department and agency has a set of authorities, jurisdictions, and responsibilities. If you carry those out in a stovepipe, you'll have met your legislative mandate, but you'll probably fail the American public. What they want to know is, how is this all knitted together so government looks coherent and is managing the entire needs across an event?
And while you were managing the response from the federal government side in the BP oil spill, where did you see some challenges in getting everyone on the same page? And talk about some of the limitations that you had during this response.
Well, there were two major ones. The first was that the public in general and a lot of senior political leaders did not understand the role of BP and how they were supposed to be part of the response. And that took a lot of communications to move that through. Beyond that, there were a number of requirements that were generated that did not fall within the authorities and jurisdictions of the federal government to pay for during an oil spill response. And that includes things like mental health problems, seafood testing, and so forth. And you have to deal with those issues because the public expects that you will.
And how do you go about managing the expectations of the public, given limitations that you have in your position and things that you maybe can and can't do that they don't know about?
Well, I think that's the root of the problem. We need to have a frank, open conversation inside government with the American people about what they can expect from government and, frankly, what we should expect from them. I mean, there's a real issue about resiliency and personal preparedness and state and local governments being prepared, too. Whether it's the oil spill or the hurricane or an earthquake or whatever, those events don't cause the pre-existing conditions that sometimes are exacerbated by the event itself. If you have issues related to public health, environmental, ecological issues, and then you have an event like this, it's like somebody with a very low immune system getting sick. Mm-hmm. I think it's a responsibility of everybody to look at it.
Now, you also mentioned at one point about the need to take over the airspace around the BP oil spill, much like you did when you were in Haiti during that response as well. Talk a little bit about how effective that is in managing a crisis.
Well, there's no way that we would have mounted the response we did in Haiti if we didn't have control of the airspace and the landing slots. And in a similar fashion, we increased the effectiveness of this oil spill response dramatically. We started controlling the airspace and were able to deploy our air sats, especially surveillance platforms, more effectively.
And so now going forward, the BP oil spill is out of the news. Where does the situation stand now?
Well, there's still a lot to do down there. There's still oil in the marshes in places like Barataria Bay. Admiral Paul Zunkamp, who's head of the Unified Area Command, is working that. As you know, I don't have an operational role anymore. But the goal now is to finish cleaning up as much of the oil as we can until we all agree with the local governments on how clean is clean. Then after that, they're going to be looking at a natural resource damage assessment, long-term impacts, because BP will be accountable for those costs as well.
And given that every response is different, every crisis is different, what are some things that you've taken from previous experiences, Katrina, Haiti, the BP oil spill, that you think would be able to, you could carry over or another person could carry over into the next response?
Well, I think one thing that is a threat of continuity through all of them is the fact that we will never have another major event in this country where public participation will not be a major factor. Anywhere from non-governmental organizations, not-for-profits, volunteers, even extended to social media, we have to figure out a way when the government is doing something on this larger scale for the public to become involved and be able to take their passion, resources, and commitment to be able to use that.
Admiral Thad Allen, retired former commandant, U.S. Coast Guard. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Perry Hooks, president of Hooks Book Events. Perry, welcome back to the program.
Jason, always good to be here. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Now, apparently you've just gotten back from a little bit of travel, I believe, to Haiti. Is that right?
Yes. Went in September. Went with a group called Fonkazay, which is the micro-lending bank for the organized poor. And it actually ties into my business, which is kind of interesting. I learned about microcredit doing two large book events for Dr. Muhammad Yunus, who got a Nobel Prize for Peace for starting Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. So learning about microcredit, I started being a big proponent of it. I got very interested in it, but I suddenly thought maybe I better go down and see how it works in the field.
How does it work in the field?
Actually, very, very well. I cannot tell you how impressed I was with the level of employee at Fonkazay. There's so many things about it, I think, that work well. It's Haitian peer-to-peer banking. They are very involved in a holistic approach with the Haitian people about getting these women just enough money to buy maybe some goats or plant some mango trees, get a concrete floor, a tin roof, and get the children in school. Amazing. We trooped across rivers and through the mud. It was amazing to meet these incredible women who are turning their lives around with small bits of money. It doesn't take much.
Talk about peer-to-peer banking as opposed to getting money from a bigger conglomerate, maybe not even from your own country.
Well, that's what I thought was so impressive. It's Creole. The whole bank, the documents are in Creole. Many of these women are illiterate in their own language, but they teach them how to write and read in Creole. It's Haitian bankers that are going out. Generally, it's men. And I thought this was interesting. The bankers tend to be male and the clients tend to be female, but it's changing the balance on how men and women interact, that these women cannot believe that a Haitian man would be that interested in their well-being, making sure their children have vitamins, making sure they've saved enough money, making sure the goats are fed, that it's changing kind of a dynamic culturally in the country, too, that was interesting, that I found very exciting, and it works.
And how important is this initiative given the circumstances in Haiti right now? We all know what happened and what that country is going through. How important is it to have an initiative like this to be moving forward, to be building towards something?
I think it's amazing. I think Bill Clinton is behind this. He's very good friends with Ann Hastings, who's the American woman working in Haiti there. But mostly it's Haitian on Haitian, and that's why I think it's going to work. And it just doesn't take much in Haiti to pull someone out of poverty. What, maybe $50, and they can buy some goats, get a couple of mango trees or avocado trees, sell those in the markets. They help them with business planning. They help them figure out how to market their products, educate their children. And it's a bottom-up recreating the country from the bottom up with these women at the bottom of the stairs of poverty, out of poverty, into building communities.
And what did you take away from your experience there as you came home? And you got back to your business and your life. What did you take away from that experience in
Haiti? Oh, my gosh. That could be like a whole other conversation. A, how incredibly grateful I am for my life and the benefits and the sort of advantages that I have and that my children have. I remember coming home and my daughter, who's tall and big and strong and healthy, came out to hug me. And I thought, man, I'm so lucky to have a child. I don't have to worry where her next meal is coming from. So, a lot of gratitude about my life, but also more committed to this idea of the education of women all across the world and helping them get out of poverty with small loans. So I'm very committed to that, and I'm decided, being a witness to that more and more, I'm kind of more hyped up about it than I was before I left.
So let's shift gears for a minute as we come back in. What's happening now?
Oh, we got a great week. If anybody's interested in some very diverse offerings we have, the week of November 15th. Generally, our events are private with the U.S. government and corporations, but on Monday night, November 15th, we're very excited to be partnering with UDC and the UDC Law School to bring a live telecast of, get this, Jay-Z. As in Jay-Z, Mr. Beyonce, as I like to call him. Jay-Z and Cornel West, the really wonderful PhD from Princeton. They're going to be at the New York Public Library with one event Jay-Z's doing for his new book, his first book called Decoded. And we're going to hopefully fill up that UDC auditorium. It's right there on the red line at UDC Van Ness. Come, starts at 7 o'clock. We're going to have Jay-Z's new music blaring and a live telecast with Cornell interviewing Jay-Z. Very exciting.
What's the message of this event?
Well, I think there's the message of the book, which is lyrics. You know, he's a famous, you know, singer, songwriter, rapper, entrepreneur, business owner. But I think there's this other message of, hey, Cornell and Jay-Z together in a library, the visual message of books are cool, reading is cool, education is cool. So it's kind of that sort of subtle message around the book. But Jay-Z's doing this really cool thing on Bing, and if you want, go to our website at hooksbookevents.com and see. You can follow the decoding. He's got this whole wonderful way to market the book through decoding some of the lyrics, and you can do it online and follow him. So it's very exciting. But I think it's awesome for people, young people, to see Jay-Z, such a successful guy, writing a book, and then Cornel West, who's such a real force in American intellectualism, and those two together in a library is just something we couldn't pass up offering to the community.
Two very influential people who've done very different things with their lives coming together for a common event.
Yes, and we're really excited about it.
Talk a little bit about Jay-Z, if you can. He started out, obviously, as a musician and has done so much more than that. He's almost built up an empire around his name.
He's got a total empire. I think he was recently on the cover of Fortune or Forbes with Warren Buffett. You know, and he's got tickets. I don't know, his new song, New York, which you may have heard with Alicia Keys, kind of sums it up. But I do think he's somebody now who, he started out, I think, doing some sort of dubious activities, but he's now, you know, writing books, producing music, giving back, sort of modeling just how you can turn your life around and be wealthy, but also give back and be successful anyway. And I think Cornell is going to be interviewing him about his life and his lyrics. And I think we're going to learn more about him in this book, because a lot of these lyrics, I think, do need decoding. I don't get all the references, but we're going to learn more on the 15th.
Now, today at the Excellence in Government Conference here, the lunchtime keynote speaker will be Daniel Pink, the author of Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. Tell us a little bit about Dan and his latest book.
Well, Dan, I have to tell you, is a great, great friend of Hook's Book Events. He's dynamic, charming, funny, smart as a whip, a Yale-educated attorney who's never practiced. I think he decided that wasn't the road to go on. But he's looked at some real scientific research about what really motivates people. And this conference today is about peak performance with the U.S. government. And it's not always the carrot and the stick. So I think it's a great take on how to motivate people. And frankly, it works, I think, for those of people who have children. What really motivates a kid to perform and do well? It might not be, you know, I'll gladly pay you Tuesday if you do your homework today. I mean, you know, there are other things more subtle that motivate people. And I think hearing Dan Pink talk about it is going to be a real plus. And I think it's one reason there's such a great turnout today, because people really want to see Dan.
Do you think that this goes in line with the old advice about doing what you love and the money will follow?
Yes, there's definitely some of that. I think being able to master something is something he brings up. And if you, it's sort of like Hook's Book Events. I mean, I love books and ideas and have started this business, and it's just because of the passion, it's growing all the time. I think that's absolutely true, because a lot of times people just want to do well, and they might just want to be recognized versus given, you know, a bonus, or I'll do this for $50. Sometimes that doesn't even really motivate people.
And sometimes for people, it's not about the money.
No.
We hear that a lot of times.
Right. Well, there's research. It's autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And if you think about that, having some independence, and you see that a lot with the young people coming into the market, into the business world, they're very autonomous. They prefer being autonomous. They like to master what they're doing. They want to be really good at it. And they want it to have purpose. I think that's why you see also a lot of these young people starting NGOs on their own. There's a big article, Nick Kristoff in the New York Times last week, about just 20-something kids seeing a need and doing something to give back. Teach for America is about as competitive as getting a job at Goldman Sachs. So I think having purpose in your work is critical. And we feel that way with Hooks Book Events, that we're bringing new ideas and smart people directly to closed environments for change.
And that's a great fit for today's event here at Excellence in Government, because a lot of people that get into the federal government obviously know that it's not a huge money-making venture.
Right.
They come to the federal government because they have a sense of purpose. They care deeply about the mission. They
right.
want to do well. They want to serve their agency. They want to serve the public. They want to do a greater good for the country.
Absolutely. And that's critical. When you look at the issues facing, from terrorism, the economy, to wars, you know, the U.S. government employee, the more sharp they are, the more on task and purpose, we want them to feel that way. And I think Dan is going to bring to table how to keep that momentum going, because there's so many problems they're working on.
And in today's day and age, especially right now in the political season and the environment that we're in, it's easy to take a shot at the federal government and say the employees don't do a good job. And people who work in the federal government or serve the federal government in some capacity know that that is the farthest thing from the truth.
Absolutely.
The federal employees do a phenomenal job, and they're here for a very noble reason. And the federal government is loaded top to bottom with very smart, dedicated people.
All right. Look around here today. There are about 400 or 500 in this room of super smart, super on task, driven employees that want to make this government better and get the job done.
So take us through the next couple of weeks with Hooks Book Events. What do you have coming up? What's in the cooker?
Well, it's kind of exciting. We've got also the same week, we've got Jay-Z and Cornel West. We've got Jim Wolfenson, who is former president of the World Bank. That's a public event if anybody's interested in having breakfast with him here at the Ronald Reagan Building on the Friday the 19th. I would highly recommend that. He's a very accomplished gentleman with a great story about his life at the World Bank. He plays the cello. He's worked on global poverty. So that should be a really wonderful event. We've got interesting week this week. We've got a bank client with three events this week, one in New York, one in Baltimore, and one in D.C., all with the same organization, a corporate bank. And we're very excited about being able to offer events in different locations. And we have a small Boston office as well. So we're kind of booming. Lee Woodruff is back in town this week. We're excited to have her back. We always love working with her, taking her to an event, a luncheon event and a bank event on Thursday night. Already got a pretty robust calendar for 2011 with Joseph Nye. We'll be back. We just worked with him. For those of you who have been to the Kennedy School, he's a former dean. We worked with him recently on his book on leadership. He's got a new book coming out on kind of global issues in first quarter. Francis Fukuyama will be in town with a book. We're taking him to a government agency and to, or possibly two. Linda Tarr Whelan will be back in town. I'm real excited to be working with her again. This concept of women in leadership and the 30% solution, that if any corporate board or government agency or any organization has 30% women in charge, you're going to see a shift. And I believe Brazil just elected a female president over the weekend. Liberia and Somalia are doing that. I think they've realized that women maybe might not be as violent as the men who've been running those places. So we'll be bringing her to Women in Government, Executive Women in Government, I think, in March. So we've got a very robust first quarter lining up.
And if federal employees out there want to take part in some of these events, how can they find you and get involved?
Check out our website, hooksbookevents.com, or email me directly, Perry, P-E-R-R-Y, at hooksbookevents.com. And many of the writers on our website now, there may be space on their calendars when they're in town, and they could maybe come to your agency and for a conversation.
Perry Hooks, president of Hooks Book Events. Perry, as always, thank you for your time.
Good to be here, Jason. Always good to see you.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Daniel Pink, the author of Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your new book, Drive.
Well, this book looks at about 50 years of behavioral science and the investigations that social scientists around the world have done into the incredibly interesting topic of human motivation. We have a sense in our heads of what motivates people. You reward something, you get more of the behavior. You punish it, you get less of it. And it turns out, if you really dive into the science, that it's a little bit more complicated than that. And if the science is right, it ends up overturning a lot of orthodoxies about how we run organizations.
And in your book, you mention a lot about the carrot and the stick approach.
Right.
Tell us about that and how maybe that's not what motivates us or what we thought it was.
Well, here's the thing about carrots and sticks. I mean, they are effective motivators. They really are. They're very good at motivators for relatively simple, straightforward tasks. If I want you to stuff envelopes, if I want you to turn the same screw the same way on an assembly line, if I want just short-term results, I want you to hustle now, and I don't care about your performance a week from now or a year from now or any collateral damage you might do to the system, they're pretty good. The problem is that those certain kinds of motivators, certain kinds of carrots, not all carrots, particularly a set of motivators that I call if-then rewards, as in if you do this, then you get that, they don't work very well for the complicated conceptual creative tasks. And what's important about that is that today, not only in the federal workforce, but in throughout state, county, local government workforces and into the private sector, you have far fewer people doing routine, simple work and a lot more people doing more complicated, creative, sophisticated work. And we have a set of motivators that just don't work very well.
And talk about some of that complicated, sophisticated work. I know we're here at the Excellence in Government Conference, and we're surrounded by key workers in the federal government, and the work that they do is complicated. It is complex.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I think that's true of a whole variety of federal work. I mean, if you look at, say, Homeland Security, and how do you anticipate the next big threat coming in? That's not an algorithmic problem. If you look at how do the people in the Treasury Department or the SEC or FinCEN, how do they regulate financial markets that are now fast-moving and complex and tumultuous? If you look at someone litigating for the Justice Department, that's not routine work. If you look at coming up with new ways to both promulgate and enforce environmental regulations, that's not routine work. So a huge amount of what the federal workforce does isn't simple. It's not algorithmic. And so, while we tend to think that pay per performance is inherently good in all times, it actually is a little bit more complicated than that.
And expand on that a little bit and talk about maybe some alternatives to a pay per performance model that could be out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing that you could, I mean, the interesting thing about pay per performance in the federal government and the use of carrots in the federal government is that the federal government doesn't have a lot of carrots. So it isn't like the private sector, and it can't say, ooh, we're going to pay you some kind of outsized bonus for a short-term result. And I think what, the best use of money, the research shows, in motivational terms, is to pay people enough so that they're not thinking about money. Pay people healthy base salaries, pay them enough so that you take the issue of money off the table. And then once you do that, allowing people enormous amounts of autonomy, which I think is something often lacking in some federal jobs, allowing people to get better at something that matters, and then plugging people into something purposeful, plugging people into a cause larger than themselves, which I think that in the federal workforce is in some ways baked right into the proposition.
Those three things, autonomy, mastery, and purpose, you've identified as the three elements of true motivation.
Right.
So expand on that a little bit and how important those three are.
Well, what it means is that if you want people to do, complicated, sophisticated, creative things over the long haul, that is really the recipe. Pay people enough and then, on autonomy, give people enormous amounts of self-direction and autonomy over their time, over their team, over their task, and over their technique. When they do their work, what they actually do, how they do it, who they do it with. And what we're after now in the white-collar workforce today isn't compliance, but engagement. And in many ways, carrot and stick motivators and even the very notion of management itself isn't built for engagement. It's built to get people to be compliant. And we want that sometimes, but in general, we want engagement. And the only way that human beings engage is if they get there under their own steam. No one can control you, manage you into being engaged. You got to get there on your own. And that requires enormous amounts of autonomy so people can have these, sovereignty over these various aspects of their life. And I think one of the things that's interesting going on out there in the private sector are these instances of, fairly radical levels of autonomy. So you have companies, one company I'm going to talk about here at this Excellence in Government conference is a company called Atlassian, an Australian company, that once a quarter on Thursday afternoon says to its software developers, go work on anything you want, as long as it's not part of your regular job. Do whatever you want, however you want, with whoever you want. The only thing we ask is that you show what you've created to the rest of the company on Friday afternoon, okay? And they call these things FedEx days because you have to deliver something overnight. It turns out that this one day, seriously, one day of intense autonomy has led to all of these ideas for new products, all of these ideas for reforms of processes internally, all of these fixes to existing products that didn't otherwise never emerge. This is not dangling a carrot out there and saying, hey, if you do something groovy, I'll give you a carrot. It's saying, let me get out of your way, because you probably want to do that.
And this sounds a lot almost like what Google does with their company.
Well, that's exactly right. In fact, you anticipated that precisely, because what Atlassian did, it worked so well, they went to 20% time, where people can spend 20% of their time working on whatever they want. Google has done this since its inception. That's where Google News came from. Google News was not an official project. It was a 20% project. Any of your listeners who have a Gmail account should know that Gmail was not an official project. It came from somebody's 20% time. It's done one of Genentech, the big biotech company in Northern California, one of its blockbuster cancer drugs was created by a guy on his 20% time. And I actually have this example here to talk about today. The guy who just won the Nobel Prize in physics for discovering graphene, he won his Nobel Prize for work he did that wasn't officially funded, that we didn't have a paper due, where he carved out in his laboratory on Friday evenings a few hours where people could just do whatever they wanted. Called them Friday evening experiments, and that's what led to graphene. And so, you know, if you really want people to do breakthrough work, you got to let them loose. You got to give them that level of autonomy. And I think in many ways, the workforce in general and the federal workforce in particular isn't built that way. The systems are not built that way. The systems in some ways presume that if you leave people alone, they're going to shirk. So what we have to do is monitor them, control them so they comply. And I think that's the wrong way to go about it.
And let's be clear, this, what you're talking about, is backed up by decades of scientific research.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. What's interesting about it is that if you look at some of the best practices in the corporate world, and then you look at what actually the science tells us about what motivates people, you see a lot of consonance between the two. Now, that said, what you also have is many organizations, both inside and out, you know, private sector, nonprofit, government sector, are still essentially operating by outdated orthodoxies. They think the solution to every problem is to throw more carrots or throw more sticks at it. And, you know, I don't really... So there's some people who would say that's not a moral thing to do. That's an inhumane way to treat people. I don't even have a dog in that fight. I just say there are 50 years of science that says it doesn't work very well.
So where do we go from here? I mean, this is a fascinating topic. Where do we take it from here to get to that next level?
Well, I think in the government workforce, it's about making small steps. Usually these things don't take, you know, nobody waves a magic wand and things change. And I think there are some good examples of that. If you look at this Office of Personnel Management, OPM just went to a pilot for something called RO, Results-Only Work Environment, which is a radical thing. It's a technique where people don't have schedules. They show up when they want, if they want. They don't have to be in the office at a certain time or any time. They just have to get the work done. Now, this has been done in a number of private sector companies. People have to get their work done. They are accountable for delivering stuff. If they don't achieve results, if they don't get results, they're in big freaking trouble. But how they get there is up to them.
What have been some of the results of this RO program?
Well, it's early in OPM's tenure here, but when it's been done in the private sector, it's been done the largest example of it is the corporate headquarters of the American electronics retailer Best Buy. It has about 5,000-6,000 people in a huge headquarters campus in Richfield, Minnesota, where about 2 out of 3 people now are on this results-only work environment. And what they've noticed is you know, interesting rises in productivity, but more important, huge declines in attrition, huge increases in job satisfaction.
This is a fascinating topic. We will be sure to keep our eyes on this in the future. Dan Pink, author of Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. Mr. Pink, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you to our guests this week, Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar, Washington Times Senior Correspondent Deborah Simmons, retired U.S. Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Thad Allen, Hooks Book Events President Perry Hooks, and author Daniel Pink. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and Dell.